And hello and welcome to the End Credits Radio Show here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. I am your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Peter Salmon.
And Peter, we are so glad that you have come out of having faked your death and
returned to
I
wasn't settled good scores. At it, I guess. I wasn't good at faking it. Try harder next time.
That's...
I'm kidding.
That's the lesson of the Equalizer, I think. Try harder to fake your death. We'll talk about that in a second. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans, and you can find us here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies. This week will be the new action-slash-crime movie sequel, The Equalizer 2. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the recent news items from the past week, including David Cronenberg. He says it's the end of cinema as we know it, and he feels fine. So should we feel fine, too? And then Logan was the most complained about movie to the British Film Classification Board for 2017, but it's not because it's not awesome, and we'll talk about why that was. And then finally, The Dark Knight turns 10 years old this year, and we'll discuss its legacy in terms of movies in general and comic book movies in particular. But first, it was a somewhat surprising announcement on Friday that writer-director James Gunn had been fired from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. The reasons why, some old, very questionable tweets, very questionable in terms of taste.
Yeah, very questionable.
Very, very questionable. Were dug up from a conservative muckraker.
Conservative group.
Yeah, and this guy, Mike Cernovich, seems to be kind of obsessed with pedophilia.
Yeah, a bit too much.
Yeah, so like any celebrity that is against the politics of Donald Trump, he feels is a pedophile.
Yeah.
So he was able to...
him and Elon Musk seem to think a lot of people are pedos.
Yeah, that is... Yeah, Elon Musk has gone downhill lately. It's kind of weird. But, this is one of the same people who helped propagate Pizzagate, Mike Cernovich. Mm-hmm. Not to say they're accusing of James Gunn of being a pedophile, but certainly pedophilia was at the heart of some of his bad taste jokes.
Many, many different tweets and jokes. Yeah.
Yeah. And
including ones where he mentioned like NAMBLA and a lot of organization things only pedophiles know about.
Yeah.
So it was a little strange.
To put him up.
And some of them didn't even feel like jokes. I do think they were. I think he was in a kind of a character. He was a character, right?
Right. No, you're right. I think what's been interesting about this, I think, is the debate over... first of all, the reason it was done is icky because I think James Gunn was tweeting some anti-Trump stuff. And so these guys, like Mike Cernovich, were trying to defend Dear Leader and, say what you want about that. But I think what we've seen is like... there's been a spectrum of reaction. I was watching John Campia's YouTube channel last night, and he was talking about it, and he's like, I understand, and I think I agree with him. He's talking about, I understand why Disney would have to fire him. It was probably the right decision in terms of, protecting their...
And they're a kid's company.
Corporate interest.
And the focus on the drama is pedophilia, right?
Right.
Even though he's not a pedophile.
Right. But where Campia sort of disagreed was the whole thing where he was just sort of fired and just kind of pushed out the door. And, instead of doing a proper sit down and doing some kind of joint statement where James Gunn kind of voluntarily stepped away, not wanting to bring the controversy down with him because...
And he deserved that. He made the first two and they were remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, he was sort of like the creative force. I think they were looking to him to be a creative force going forward as they expand the universe further into the cosmic characters, because that's sort of been his corner of the Marvel universe, and he's been allowed to do with it pretty much as he sees fit with the Guardians characters, and he has been doing a good job. Yeah, so it's a major hit for the studio creatively because he was right in the middle of pre-production on Guardians 3.
And it might not feel as right now. It might not flow as perfectly as it would if he directed the third one as well.
It's curious because one of the things that came up on Campia's show was it was somebody mentioned, because he was reading comments, somebody was talking about Taika Waititi stepping in. Mm. And that's just one of the things I found about Thor Ragnarok, because it's also kind of in the cosmic end. And Thor Ragnarok sort of has a companion tone to the Guardians movies, that especially when you consider they both came out last year. So they were kind of in production at the same time. There was probably some overlap. So it makes you wonder maybe if...
I was kind of hoping that they would let Taika Waititi take over.
Yeah.
Because Ragnarok was hilarious, right? And the Guardians of the Galaxy was the first one of the MCUs that was genuinely also hilarious.
Openly comedic.
Yeah, because James Gunn is a comedian. Back in the day, his jokes weren't appropriate, but he's still a comedian. Right. So the Guardians of the Galaxy were funny. And Taika Waititi always has been a hilarious man. Right. So I'd be totally okay if he takes over the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, and I think I would be less concerned, too, if... You know, having seen Infinity War, where the Guardians are a part of the plot, I mean, it's... I don't think it's a proper test, but in terms of the screenwriters there and the way the Russos handled the characters, I think there's a pretty good handle after two movies of what those characters are and what the tone is of the worlds they're playing in.
Yeah, the hard part's done. They're on Earth now. They're in the rest of the MCU. They know everybody.
Right, and they're established, and the actors have done three films, so they know their parts. And the loss is because James Gunn is a very creative person, but at the same time. I think the series can survive.
Yeah. Oh, the series can. And the things happened before. I think a director got canceled. Oh, well, the first Ant-Man, right? Evan
That's
Goldberg.
Right.
And it ended up being quite well done. I think Disney can, they're quite good at fixing messes, I guess. At least when it comes to blockbuster films.
Right.
They know what kids want to see, right? Kids or the kids' parents.
Right. The other flip side of this is too is that I think for people, and there's an online petition I think with 100,000 signatures now wanting Disney to bring back James Gunn, and I think that's fine, and I think a case can be made, but you know, at the same time, this is sort of indicative of Disney maybe not being well enough prepared to tackle when these things come up, because I'm thinking of Roseanne.
They can't deal with all that drama, Disney.
Right. It seems like it, because there's also John Lasseter, too. And I forgot about John Lasseter. There were harassment allegations against John Lasseter. And he went away for a couple months, and he just sort of recently came back to work. But it's been very much on the down low. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been a lot of wave making about that, and although there is suspicions he's just going to outright leave the company before year's end, but it just seems like Disney has personnel issues
because they've got enough money that they can just ignore the issue, like what they just did. They could just fire the person and hire someone else who's better. They don't want to waste money on all the issues, or they don't want to even risk losing a couple million from the upcoming Guardians of the Galaxy 3.
Maybe, but you know, don't they lose something in terms
from the
of,
fans, from the James Gunn fans? That's a fair
not
point.
Just the fans, but like in terms of like how much press this is eating up. I mean, this was all like as Comic-Con was going on, which is, I don't think Disney had a presence there this year, but I mean, they might as well have with how much news this was making. They could have probably used the help having a Marvel panel in Hall H on Saturday night to help deflect some of this. But
well, James Gunn was supposed to be at Comic-Con.
He was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then this happened.
Yeah. So it might have been a bad decision by Disney. Maybe they should have kept him. Or like you said, done it in a more appropriate way where he's the one who left.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the things I will say is that he actually came out in like with a full-throated multi-paragraph apology and not just like a
on
tweet.
On Twitter, yeah.
Yeah, well, he did it on Twitter, but I mean, he also had an official release too, which, you know, to see an outright unconditional apology when something like this happens is also rare.
And Sean Gunn, his brother from Gilmore Girls, a listener might like Gilmore Girls. I liked it. Anyways, he made like 10 tweets. There was a huge paragraph about it. And he was saying Sean Gunn was like that or sorry, James Gunn was like that when they were kids.
Mm-hmm.
He said that him and his mom both didn't like when James Gunn was a character like that.
Mm.
So it was just comedy, you know?
Things change, still, yeah. And people change.
Yeah, I'm just saying there is a lot of people that are really just kind of trying to defend him.
Right.
Yeah, and Chris Pratt and the other co-star, Guardians of the Galaxy.
Dave Bautista, yeah.
Yeah, said today they made a lot of statements about how he was not like that on set whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think James Gunn himself has said in previous interviews he's talked about it as well.
Mm-hmm.
But
like, oh, no, these were not tweets that were deleted and somebody got screen captures of that. I think these were still on his feed from years and years ago. Because I think this came up before that he had to address it.
Yeah.
Speaking of people talking out of turn, maybe David Cronenberg, somewhat legendary.
Mm-hmm. Especially
Canadian
in Canada.
He's Toronto born and bred, but he's getting a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Venice Film Festival, and good time to say that, if you know, for him to come out and say I can't read my notes as usual. But he basically said if cinema were to die tomorrow, it wouldn't affect him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's not talking specifically about movies themselves. What he's talking about is the theater experience.
Yeah, old cinema.
Yeah. I wish I could say I was in a position to disagree.
No, I agree with him.
But yeah, it's weird. Where he kind of framed it, and he did this in an interview at another film festival, but he framed it as, the film experience isn't the communal anymore. It's, you know, it's more like reading a book, you know, when mm-hmm. you have your phone or your iPad or your computer.
And you're at home.
And yeah, you just kind of like curl up and you watch the little screen.
Yeah. And also like books, it's not like in a theater, you can just pause as much as you want. Because that's, you know, Netflix, there's some films that it takes me like 3 days to finish, right? So sure. It's like books in that sense too.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
Yeah, I when I first started reading the article, I was worried he was going to be very against the new way cinema works, but he wasn't, and I'm glad, because I still think it's pretty great in your home. I think Netflix is a fun movie theater, if you will, in a weird way.
Yeah. The like 2000 screen movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
That runs all day every day. I think you're right that we've seen the blowback from the other end, with a lot of directors say like the theater experience is sacrosanct, but I think there's room for both, because there's certainly movies, they don't happen as much, but there are movies that I think that are best, that are still being made, that are best experienced on the big screen.
Oh, 100%. I do not want old cinema to die whatsoever. Yeah. I just agree with his points of how...
His perspective is interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah.
But no, like the films we were just talking about, like MCU films, Disney films, you got to see those in theaters first. You mm-hmm. got to wear those glasses. You got to see those, like, you know, huge explosions.
Don't tell
Candace screen.
She's got to wear the glasses.
I'm not going to lie, I don't either, but a lot of people do love them.
Right. I'm not even thinking about those necessarily.
Trailers? Trailers are amazing.
I do like sitting through trailers. Yeah. I hate when people have their phones out during the trailers, or still getting up to go to get snacks during
the
trailers.
Me too. I hate that.
It's like, you can go during the commercials. I don't care about the commercials, but don't you dare go mm-hmm. during the trailers.
Because the lights have dimmed down for that too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they should know that. That's a sign.
Exactly. this is off topic, but I do love those.
We're talking about old cinema.
I do love the ads that Cineplex is running of the theater goer support group. I've seen that like about three times, and I still laugh at it. It's fun. I think it's funnier than the like Tommy Texter bits. But
And I don't know how I feel about the little Cineplex popcorn characters.
Okay. I think it's a little late to be ambiguous. They've been around for a while.
Yeah.
I think where Cronenberg, he didn't mention it, but I'll take it further, that there's still a communal aspect of cinema. I think it's in after watching, whether, you know, when you're going online and you're going on forums or you're going on Twitter and sharing your opinion or you know, posting in reviews and posting comments and things. I mean, granted, some of that can be a bitter experience if, you know, you're watching reactions to something like The Last Jedi, for example. But I think there's still a communal aspect. It's just, you don't experience a thing all at once. You don't experience it at the same time, but we do gather in some digital form afterward to to digest what we're reading. And
yeah, or if you're watching a film at home and you like tweet while you're watching it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you said, even if you're not seeing it in theaters with someone, there's still a lot of communication.
Yeah, you're right.
Also, I think even though he's a bit worried, I think theaters like The Bookshelf, that like their whole focus is on indie films and things like that. I don't think they're ever going to die fully out either.
No, I think it's going to be like video stores and newspapers. It's just you can't go big. Like there's going to be a ceiling on that. You're probably not going to go to the 20 screen multiplex like a Young Dundas Square in order to see you know, the movie of the week, the new release or something like that. But you know, for certain boutique things or for movies that have a lot of word of mouth or just for like big spectacles, I'm thinking of something like Mad Max Fury Road, which was so immersive on the big screen, but and like the point where I think it loses a step on the small screen. That, you know, those experiences I think will still be around.
Oh, always.
Yeah.
At least within our lifespan, hopefully.
40 more years. Definitely, keep it going for 40 more years.
Definitely within Cronenberg's lifespan.
Yeah. But it'd be nice if he made a movie. I don't know, like, what his...
Yeah.
He hasn't made one since...
He said in the interview that he's writing now.
Okay.
So he might have some books or novellas or something coming out. Okay. But yeah, I wish he got back to films.
Yeah. They're remaking Rabbit.
And possibly Fly, too. You don't think it's going to happen?
Well, I think it'll happen. I don't think it'll be. I'm more excited about Rabbit, directed by the Twisted Twins, than I am the Fly, like probably being remade by like Eli Roth or something. Anyway, this was kind of a funny article. Logan is the most complained about movie to the British Board of Film Classification. They got 20 complaints because people thought it was too violent to be rated 15, because they have their own rating system too, as, as sort of Ontario does, although we kind of use the American ratings.
Do you know what it was rated here?
I did look it up. It was 18A here.
Okay.
So it was basically rated R.
Yeah.
In Ontario, so but it was 15 in
15. Yeah, that's weird.
But I mean, I'm not sure what the big difference is between a 15-year-old being able to see this by themselves and an 18-year-old being to see this.
Yeah,
by themselves.
No, there's not much of a difference.
Yeah, it's just
you're in high school. You hear the swears all the time, and at 15, you're probably soon gonna, you know, see nudity and have your own romantic relationships and things. So yeah, no, I think you should 100%, especially Logan,
and killing people with your knife, your hand knives. Yeah, it's
well, maybe, yeah,
but yeah, I think
become one.
It's funny because I think in the comic books it's been, they sort of dance a fine line, especially when I was reading comics as a kid, and you know, the CCA, the Comic Codes Authority, was still in effect. But you know, You would see the panel and somebody's like uniform would be slashed, and you'd know that because he has knives for hands.
Yeah, they always. It's always different if it's books, though.
That's
like
true.
Handmaid's Tale, right?
Mm.
In Canada, you read that in grade 10. But it's. I believe the TV show is 18 plus, right?
That's a good point.
Yeah,
that's a good point. It's the other thing that tickled me is in that same article it talked about for the last 2 years or the last 3 years, the one with the movie with the most complaints last year was Deadpool.
Oh.
So it's like two for two for X-Men movies, but Deadpool had like 50 complaints and it was also rated 15.
That for me is a bit more understandable.
Yeah,
because I do think maybe it should have been 18. Well, I don't think so, but I can see why they maybe wanted it to be. There was way more swears in that than there was in Logan.
I think at least
more inappropriate jokes.
Well, I think that's the difference, though, that the violence was humorous, more humorous, and the violence was more stylized. And, you know, in Logan, it's a serious film with serious implications. I think one of the things that makes the difference in terms of what's rated 15 and what's rated 18 in Britain is that it's violence that doesn't dwell on pain or the or the person dying. So if like Wolverine just goes along and
so like violence for fun.
Well, maybe not for fun, but like I guess the effect of it. So if Wolverine just runs past and digs a guy, and, you know, and then he goes on to the next guy. But if you focus on the guy like holding his stomach and oh, he stabbed me with his hand knives.
They prefer that.
Is no, it, that would be that would make oh, it
that
an
would
18.
Make it bad. Okay,
that would make it an 18. The 15,
and there is a lot of
you
that.
Can slash and get away and run away, but an okay. 18, if you're showing like people holding in their guts, that's maybe an 18.
I guess you get more emotionally attached to the person, so it hurts you more when they die.
Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know.
We just thought that was a funny story and we wanted to share.
Well, when you sent the email that the focus was going to be on all the hatred that Logan got, I thought, like, what, in the UK, did they hate that film? Like, we loved it here.
No, but I thought that same thing, and then I clicked on it, I read it, and I was like, oh, I'm going to send this to Peter.
Yeah.
See if he has the same reaction. But, I mean, it's still funny that...
all those complaints, yeah. Just
that people
Logan.
Get their that people. This was like the 10th movie with that character, and people are getting their hair in a bunch because a guy with knives for hands is running around stabbing people. Anyway, mm-hmm. Speaking of people with knives, The Dark Knight turned 10. It was only released 10. Yeah, I know it was released 10 years ago, either this week or last week. I think it was last week. But since we talked about Die Hard last week, we're talking about Dark Knight this week because it's anniversary month, I guess. But it's interesting to talk about this now because the direction the comic movies have gone in. Because this was a very interesting year because you had Iron Man and Dark Knight in the same year.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them kind of went on to set the tone for every comic book movie. And then... you had The Dark Knight, which Warner Brothers tried to copy that tone going into its expanded universe films. They brought, like, people may forget, Christopher Nolan was brought in to sort of creatively shepherd Man of Steel.
I remember seeing his name in the credits, yeah.
So they were trying to transfer the Nolan touch from Batman to Superman, and then by proxy to the rest of the DC universe movies, which has been... I think a lot of people would agree, unsuccessful.
Very, very unsuccessful.
So it's fascinating how, even though the one was more successful in terms of mm-hmm. box office and critical praise, it's the Iron Man effect that has sort of carried on in the last 10 years and sort of been transposed onto just about every comic book movie that's come since.
Including ones that aren't even attached to the MCU.
Yeah.
They still take a lot of elements, from Iron Man.
Yeah.
But I think because of that, we might remember The Dark Knight even more because it's more of a singular film, or at least that trilogy is. And whereas Iron Man we view as, a huge blockbuster led to a lot of things, all those blockbusters that it led to are still happening. Mm-hmm. So we might forget about the Iron Man because we've still got pretty much the Iron Man, you know?
Right.
We probably have an Iron Man 4 coming for all we know. But The Dark Knight was... a very singular standalone. Like, you can watch that without the first or the third, too.
Oh, and, for sure.
You know, it's
a complete movie.
Yeah, and it won an Oscar for Heath Ledger.
Mm-hmm.
Christian Bale did a phenomenal role, way better than Ben Affleck, and I love Ben Affleck.
Mm-hmm.
And Christopher Nolan, he had way more control. So the shots and even if they tried really hard, I don't think Zack Snyder would have been able to make Gotham look the way Christopher Nolan did. It's what he's best at, like Interstellar, right? Inception. He knows how to make amazing visuals. And he knows how to make it so the visuals immerse you into the world.
Right.
So.
And Gotham was mostly Chicago, which was...
Yeah.
When he did Batman Begins, that was a weird direction for a Batman movie to actually take somewhere and turn it into Gotham City versus like building a few blocks of Gotham City on a soundstage, which
Chicago
is what happened from Batman Returns, Batman Forever, and Batman and Robin. It was all models and stagecraft. Mm-hmm.
Christopher Nolan is a lot of small things, but it matters, you know? Even if you don't know it matters, even if your eyes don't see it,
mm-hmm.
your brain on the inside is going to feel it, I guess. I don't know.
Well, yeah, you can definitely tell when things are real and when things are not real.
You can get more immersed into his films, like his Batman.
You watch enough TV, you can tell when they're shooting New York on a soundstage and when they're actually in New York City.
Yeah, or in the MCU films, like Avengers, when it's in Toronto. you're Canadian, you 100% can tell.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of times. I mean, the Shazam trailer came out over the weekend, and you can tell that was shot in Toronto.
Yeah.
Just from the trailer.
Yeah. But The Dark Knight, you feel like you're in that world and that it's real the whole time. Because like you said, it is. It's all filmed in Chicago.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Chicago, unfortunately, is a perfect place to represent Gotham. Chicago or Detroit would have been a smart choice too.
Well, it's the Windy City, so it's great Cape weather all the time.
Yeah, exactly. So for that, I think it'll be remembered.
Yeah.
Even though Iron Man did take over when it comes to just superhero films as a whole.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. I think Dark Knight, no matter what year it was released, would stand out anyway. I think when you're talking about the best superhero movies ever, I think it's... At least for me, it's between Superman, the original Superman movie, and The Dark Knight. And they're both very different films. And even, you know, within the spans of just that the Nolan Batman movies, you go from Batman Begins, that is a much more comic book movie type of movie than The Dark Knight, which is basically a crime thriller with two people in costumes. And, you know, it's also got a downer ending. And, you know, it's not exactly a superhero ending. This hero is not triumphant in the end. The hero makes a moral compromise to, you know, make someone who became a bad guy into the actual hero.
Yeah, you get more emotionally attached to the Batman and his too.
Yeah. It's, you know, and one of the things I also appreciate is that attention to those characters, that they're more than, they are fully formed characters, full-blooded characters, and even, you know, supporting characters like Commissioner Gordon. Has a great arc in The Dark Knight.
Or the Sandman, right? The Sandman, or the main villain in the first one?
Oh, Scarecrow.
Scarecrow, not Sandman, yeah. And the Scarecrow, like, he's in all three, but sometimes just like a little, just for a little pinch, right? But that's the real world.
And it also calls back to the comics too, because Batman doesn't kill. He doesn't kill, but he doesn't have to save either. He doesn't kill, so the villains do keep coming back. So I mean, I do love that element as a comic book reader when Scarecrow keeps popping up. What are your thoughts before we close out? What are your thoughts on Dark Knight Rises?
I don't think it's as good.
No, it's not as good.
No, I think it's okay, but I think it's more like the first one. It feels more just like a regular comic book action film.
Interesting.
But at the same time, when I saw it, it was right after Heath Ledger's death, right? So it was hard to be able to fully get immersed in it with Tom Hardy. Like, he was great, but you can't beat Heath Ledger as the Joker.
No.
I think even if he was alive, he deserved that Academy Award.
You know, I did look up who else was up for Best Supporting in 2009, and it was Josh Brolin for Milk, Robert Downey Jr. for Tropic Thunder, Philip Seymour Hoffman for Doubt, and Michael Shannon for Revolutionary Road. So
I would have been okay if Josh Brolin won.
I would have been okay with that too, but I think if Heath Ledger had lived, he probably would have won.
Yeah, and Josh Brolin, I don't know if he's won any Oscars before, but he's...
I don't think so.
He's... Since, you know, but the, what, the 80s or late 70s, he's been, 80s, Goonies. He's been very consistent, especially right now, so.
he's had a good year. I have a suspicion it might have gone to Brolin, but I don't think anyone would have been mad if, because I think it's seen that it was a, because Heath Ledger had died, it was a nice posthumous tip of the hat to a very good actor. Who was gone before his time, and whether that was, you know, you're looking at Brokeback or even something like 10 Things I Hate About You.
Or that jousting film, my one drama Knight's teacher Tale? Made me watch. Yeah.
with Queen.
Yep. It was enjoyable.
It has its moments.
Yeah. But that's what I mean. Even in bad films, he was great.
Yes, he was. He will be missed. And I want to give a tip of the hat to someone else who passed last week, John Schnepp, who was a host on the Collider Networks of shows. He had a stroke, and unfortunately, he passed away a couple days later after trying to get some treatment in the hospital. He's also he worked on animation. He was the director on the Metalpocalypse series.
Yeah, the Adult Swim show, right? It's hilarious.
And he also directed the documentary The Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, which was an exploration of the Tim Burton Superman movie that never happened. And he got such great access to pretty much all the principals, including Tim Burton himself. And I enjoyed that movie a lot. And so I also enjoyed Schnepp as like a super fan. You can call him Schnepp because, everyone did. And yeah. he felt like he was a friend. And so, it's a rip to John Schnepp because he will be missed. And because he lives in the United States, there's actually a GoFundMe page to cover his medical expenses. Not only is his fiance and his family dealing with his death, they're also dealing with the frickin' hospital because the United States doesn't have universal health care. So, if you like John Schnepp, kick back a couple of bucks. So anyway,
do it.
Thanks, Peter. So we're going to take a break here and play a little Cadence Weapon, Hope in Dirt City, which I think will be a adequate lead in to our discussion of The Equalizer 2. And we'll review that coming up next. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. Sometimes it seems so gray. Doesn't mean we can't be friends. A menace comes over the city, and I can't get over it. Sometimes it seems too gray. Doesn't mean we can't be friends. And hope's name was on your way back. I live here, but at least I have friends. Go up too fast, you might get the bends. Being counters for spins, I sleep above trends. How you doing? I'm the Lyft driver that you called to take home your girlfriend.
Not a girlfriend, man.
Oh, credit card was invalid.
Come in. There you go. Pay yourself whatever and give yourself a nice tip.
Thank you. You're not going to ask me if you got home okay? This is the point where usually I'd give you a chance to do the right thing, but not tonight. Tonight I'm going to need your cameras, cell phones, anything you might have used to record what you did to her.
You knocked on the wrong door tonight, Pops.
And that was a clip from The Equalizer 2. It's the new film from Antoine Fuqua, and it stars Denzel Washington, Pedro Pascal, Ashton Sanders, Bill Pullman, and Melissa Leo. Probably the best commercial Lyft has never paid for. Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't know. Lyft might have given them some money.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, but no, Lyft was very prominent, yes. Especially the commercial.
It is.
Where's Uber?
That's a good question. Yeah. Maybe Uber didn't want to. It could be that thing where they went to Uber first and said, you know what? We want to make Denzel Washington the lethalist Uber driver in Boston. They were like, no thanks. And it's a, hey, Lyft. And because it's Lyft, and they're kind of more upstart. But we were talking during the break about the original Equalizer, or I should say the Antoine Fuqua. Initial film, The Equalizer, because the original Equalizer was, of course, a TV show in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. But I think that the original Equalizer starring Denzel Washington is a perfectly serviceable film. I don't think there's, it's kind of weird. I think there's some parts of this I liked better than what was done in the first, but
I liked this whole film. Just by itself better than the first one.
Interesting.
Yeah. We were talking about this too. I just found in the first one the Chloe Grace Moretz connection a little strange. A little bit too much like Taxi Driver.
Yeah. Yes. Her being a prostitute and all. And I think
it's unfortunately, realistic. There's things like that.
Yeah. I don't think it was ever icky at all, which could have been different because, there's... I think I like the McCall character, and Denzel is infinitely
remarkable, the character,
charismatic,
and he
was really good at sort of playing these aspects of the character, like his OCD-ness, which I think mm-hmm. was kind of downplayed here, but
and his sorrow,
his loss. Yeah, and I think that's where I like the first film a bit better, is that it was able there was a bit more of that characterization, and I mm-hmm. think in Equalizer 2 it was more like, let Denzel be Denzel.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot more laughter. And mm-hmm.
But his sadness and his losses are still very prominent.
Yeah.
And it's like, it wasn't the first one, so maybe he should have gotten more over it. It's been a while, Denzel. But no, it's the sequel, and not everyone's going to see the first. So it was still good they did that, because it shows why he's doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
And you see his emotions. You get to relate to him.
Yeah, I almost felt, though, that it was redundant, because I think the through line for the first movie was that him, like, helping other people and using his, like, super spy skills mm-hmm. to, you know, judo chop, you know, the corrupt cops or you know, Russian gangsters or mm-hmm. whatever, as a way of helping him sleep at night. And I feel like
he
goes back to the first base, and it's, you know, he's still having trouble, even though he's doing yeah. all the butt-kicking stuff. And
he's using it more as therapy in the second one, too. Like, he's purposely mm-hmm. finding people to kick their butts. Just to vent.
Right. Yeah, you're right. In the first one, it's... it is kind of accidental.
Yeah.
he kind of finds himself. But I think that's part of the Lyft gig, is that it yep. gives him time to travel on the...
And find the right people.
Right.
But because of that, I thought it was more fun than the first one.
There are parts of it that are fun. I like the scenes where he's like helping the, you know, the average everyday folk, helping the helpless, mm-hmm. to borrow a phrase from
there's
early 2000s.
A small little storyline throughout it all about a senior who had to deal with, I think World War II and the Holocaust, right?
Yeah, he's trying to get back a yeah. painting that was stolen from his family.
Yeah, so Denzel's still good enough of a man for you to be able to enjoy what he's doing.
Yeah, I think...
Robert McCall,
yeah. not Denzel, he's not Denzel. But I think... That plays into something that bothered me about two films, and it's something that bothers me with a lot of like TV to movie adaptations, mm-hmm. where just like, we gotta sort of lobotomize the concept, and he's dealing with stuff like from his years as a spy and when his wife died, and it's like, yeah, I mean, that stuff's important to know for motivation, but you could probably count on one hand the number of times the Equalizer, the TV show, dealt with like why McCall was doing the things he did.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be mentioned over and over again.
I like the A-Team movie,
mm-hmm.
but I don't need to see how the A-Team got together.
No.
I need to know what crime they were framed for. I just need to know that they're former military guys, rogues on the run, helping people and, mm. you know, getting into cool adventures and driving that van off ramps and stuff.
And Antoine should know by now that that's what people are expecting from his films. That's what they're all about, right? They're action adventure.
Yeah.
You know, you just need a little sprinkle of the emotions of the character so you can, you know, fully immerse yourself and enjoy all the action. But he did make it, I think, a bit too prominent.
Yeah, although,
in this one.
Yeah, it's because it's his friend from the spy world, Melissa mm-hmm. Leo, who is in the first one, too. But she's killed, and so he sort of dedicates himself to finding out why, mm-hmm. and, you know, it involves, you know... That happens
midway through, though. I think it would be
right.
more understandable if that happened earlier.
There's that, too.
But I still thought the pacing was okay.
The pacing was okay.
Yeah. There was enough sprinkles of fights for you not to ever get fully bored.
Right. I think what it does is it makes it about the character McCall, and that's the focus in his interactions. And it's not like in the first film where we see a lot of stuff like going on the periphery and, mm-hmm. You know, watching the Russian gangster, you know, go about... Interestingly, the guy who's the main Russian gangster, guy who was the villain in the first XXX movie.
There was a lot more side storylines going on.
There was a lot more side stories going on, which made...
But he dealt with all those side storylines and the people in them, right? That's why he doesn't need one anymore.
Yeah.
No, I thought it was just, it's the sequel. It's an action adventure. I think Antoine just realized that Robert McCall, not Denzel, was the main focus, right? Like, the people watching it just loved him and watched him killing people.
Yeah.
So I think that's why he, you know, made him the only kind of storyline. There wasn't really any side storylines or anything.
Yeah. Do you think there's a limitation to this subgenre of, like, older, well-known actors, you know, becoming, you know, action stars? Because I think that's almost its own subgenre now.
But do you think it's new for Denzel? I think he's been doing it for a while.
I'm trying to think of, like, an out-and-out action movie he's done, because something like Crimson Tide comes to mind, but he's not really, like, fighting his way through it. I mean, it's a thriller, but it's not really action-centric.
Yeah. Isn't he in The Taking of Pelham, or is that Morgan? No, I don't think he's
that
was
The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3, but he's
it's
not...
It's pretty action-adventure, just straight-up thriller.
He's mostly behind a mic through the film, though.
I guess, yeah.
I mean...
But the film as a whole.
I guess.
But, Book of Eli, but I guess that's dystopian, so it does
Book
have...
Book of Eli. But,
does
I mean, that was only... I want to say 10 years ago.
That was...
It was 10 years ago.
2009, I think. Or was it
almost
2010?
10 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. Almost
10
years ago.
So, I mean, okay, maybe you're right, but it's...
So the difference of what he's doing and what other people like Bruce Willis are doing, or...
Bruce Willis.
Yeah, or I guess Sylvester Stallone, too, just doing more straight-up action and only that. It's because that's all they can do.
Mm.
They're not popular enough now to be in, you know, critically acclaimed films. Whereas Denzel Washington, Fences, was just, 2016 Oscars and won. So I honestly just think he's buds with Antoine and doing this one for fun.
It might be, because I think he's had that mode, because the other movie he did in 2016 was The Magnificent Seven, which was also Antoine Fuqua. Also a remake Antoine Fuqua.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's weird because, you know, thinking about Magnificent Seven now, it was actually on TMN the other night and I was watching it. It's not great, but, you know, the first Magnificent Seven wasn't really that great either. But
I remember it was quite popular.
It's popular, but it's not, it doesn't like break the mold. It's
no.
It's a very straightforward Western, but because it has Steve McQueen and Yul Brynner and you know, a ton of people you recognize in it. But, you know, he seemed to understand maybe the value of mystique a bit more in that character. That character that Denzel Washington plays, I mean, it's The Magnificent Seven, is tortured too, but... It isn't like the focus of the whole movie.
It's not
kind of
mentioned
sits
over
there
and over.
In the background of your, because you understand that the Denzel character has a history with the Peter Skarsgård villain, but it's not really fully explained what that is until the climax when they come face to face.
Well, a lot of times that makes you relate even more to the character.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it so you're thinking, you're trying to guess more details about what you just learned, right? The little sprinkle of information about him.
Right.
Whereas in this, we hear so much about Denzel Washington's character.
And his wife. And
it's enough. Yeah. We don't care.
How he should go home. And But, you know, there's a scene in The Magnificent Seven where you see him, like, kind of rubbing his neck, but you don't see what he's rubbing. And then in the end, you see it's a scar from where they tried to hang him, where they tried to kill him. One of the things I did like about Equalizer 2, I thought the climax was... I miss kind of like the Home Alone aspect of the first one with like using like the power tool aisle in Home Depot as your arsenal. But
yeah.
I thought the climax in Equalizer 2 was very well realized in that, like in the abandoned town in the hurricane.
Mm-hmm. And it was his like original town, right? Like the little house where he grew up?
It's his hometown, yeah.
I also thought, when it comes just to individual parts of the film that were great, the opening scene.
Oh, yeah.
I loved it. I thought it could have just been a short film. It's just great. I couldn't even tell it was he's in a disguise. I couldn't even tell it was him at first.
Mm-hmm. And there's a nice callback to that later when he's in the bookstore and he sees a little girl and he puts his finger to his lips.
Yep.
Because he's on the down low as a superhero by night, I did like the opening. What I liked about the climax too, it is that I think where Antoine Fuqua is really good is like the geography of the scene. You always kind of understand where people are in relation to other people. You don't really ever feel lost because it feels like a city block that it takes place in.
The whole little town.
Yeah, plus there's like a hurricane going on. And
yeah, but you know where all the sniper guys are. You know where all the troops are shuffling to.
Right.
And you're able to guess where Denzel is, where where Mikal is.
Yeah, so I like that a lot. And I did like the friendship he has with Miles, who's a teenage kid.
I loved that. I was really glad they put that in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I guess that, in a weird way, was kind of a little side storyline of another individual.
But, it's still in keeping with
his
journey, because, like, Miles is kind of what keeps him grounded in he could have shut off entirely, but then he... In the middle of him trying to track down his friend's murderer, he notices that Miles isn't around so much anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was a really powerful scene when he goes to the, the gang lair and pulls Miles out. And
he saves Miles, yeah.
You know, and not just that, though, but the scene when they're in the lobby of the building and he rages against Miles about, being a gang member and killing people, because I mean that also brings a lot of his that feeds really well into the main thrust of the story, that he is a killer, McCall, I mean, that he's a killer, he has experience in the military killing people, and well, not just the military, but as the Equalizer, he's done it for like king and country, so to speak. And you have this kid here who's talking about going out and getting revenge for his brother's murder, and you know the kid doesn't know what it's cost, and it's also about gang initiation, like you got to kill this person so you can be in with us, and just the rage of the character of like translating his experiences killing for the quote unquote good versus trying to get the kid on a better track.
He saves him from going down. Yeah, the wrong track.
There was just something about that scene because of, all the sociopolitical stuff about, black youths in America and what options they have. And even the talented ones and the ones with opportunity.
And all the recent
can go
things.
Down. Yeah.
All the deaths.
Yeah. Yeah.
Rest in peace, X.
Right, and you can't necessarily look up to the authority figures.
Yeah, no, you can't.
But you can look up to
the
old recluses living in your building and maybe knock some sense into you.
But especially people like Mikal who help young individuals like that out.
Mm-hmm. So, something like that really, that scene I found particularly powerful.
Yeah, I honestly think he actually should have been more part of the plot. Miles Whitaker, his character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's
– Yeah.
I mean, if there was one scene that kind of made it worth going to – in terms of the dramatics, I mean, not necessarily action, because the film is a solid action movie, but
– Yeah, and that was, like, right in the middle. So even though of all the flaws we've talked about, like I said, the very first scene is amazing. That scene right in the middle is amazing. And the end fight, like you were saying, is pretty great. So I think the flow of it is all right.
Mm-hmm.
The only negative is just too many little sprinkles of, like, we get it, Mikal. You lost your family. We get it. We already gotten it by the first film. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, you faked your death, you say.
Yeah.
Interesting. Because there's kind of that, because he's going back into the spy world, there's that scene where again and again he kind of has to reveal himself. And you're like, oh, you're not dead? What? and that's Pedro Pascal, who I was trying to think
Oberyn.
Who that was. Yeah, he's Oberyn Martell from Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
Not as flashy here.
No, and also his name is second, but he's not in it until the last half hour.
No, he's in it through because he goes to Brussels with the Melissa Leo.
Right. Okay, yes.
But yeah, it's I was reading some of the posts on people commenting on this movie, and it's like, well, if there's one lesson to take from this movie again and again, it's like you don't trust your old army buddy.
Unfortunately,
because somebody directly referenced The Punisher, because The Punisher, the Netflix Punisher, has the same plot of like the army buddy backstabbed him. It's concerning. You can't trust your old army buddies. Mm-hmm.
I think Forrest Gump proved that wrong.
He
stays buds with that dude.
with
In the wheelchair.
Bubba, oh, I thought you meant.
Oh, yeah, and Bubba Gump.
Because he keeps his word to Bubba
Yeah.
About starting the shrimping boat, and then Lieutenant Dan keeps his word because Lieutenant Dan says, you know, if you're ever a shrimping boat captain, I'll be your first mate.
Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I do think Equalizer 2 and The Punisher might be more realistic. Unfortunately.
That's a bold pronouncement. This movie may be more realistic than Forrest Gump.
I think so.
I think I'm wondering too about, you know, where Denzel goes from here, because he has done the fences, like mm-hmm. you said. I think Anton Fuqua has almost become his new, like, Tony Scott, because he used to do, like, the Tony Scott movies, and those are very, like, escapist-driven. He did, like, mm-hmm. things like, is it About Time? No, that's the other one with Rachel McAdams. But he did one where he's, like, time-traveling or something, and that was a Tony Scott film.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like Fuqua's kind of filled that hole, that escapist hole that he needs to fill before he goes and does the serious thing. I also wonder where Anton Fuqua goes, because like four of his last five films have been like remakes or sequels yeah. to remakes, or like in the case of
King
Olympus,
Arthur was based on, you know, obviously in numerous movies beforehand and tales and
based on the quasi mythical, quasi historical. Yeah. But I mean, just in the last,
that's what he's good at, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, just in the last few, I mean, his big thing was Training Day. His big mm-hmm. breakthrough was Training Day, which, you know, Denzel got an Oscar. It was something that's been sort of repeated and copied and has been a huge influence. I just mean, like, in the last 5 years, he's done Olympus Has Fallen and Magnificent Seven, Equalizer 1 and 2. But then he also did Southpaw.
Mm-hmm.
I could see if he's sort of, like, doing one for the studio and one for me and that kind of thing. But
I feel like the Equalizer's for him.
You think so?
I think so. They're pretty just focused on the action and the fun. Whereas Magnificent Seven is pretty, he made it so it would get, you know, good reviews as well.
So it opened TIFF.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it did quite well. I didn't see it, but I remember it did really, really well. And I was surprised because, like you said, it's a remake. And then that remake was a remake, right, of Seven Samurai?
Yeah.
Yeah. But because of that, I think since he's done the two Equalizers, his next one might be, you know, when he wants to win an Oscar or something like that.
Right. I mean, that's what I'm curious about. Like, he's done sort of like silly-ish action movies. Like, he did Shooter. We were talking about that
yeah,
before.
Yeah, Shooter.
That, you
amazing.
Know, it's perfectly fine.
Yeah, it's 10 movie. Out of 10.
Great, great little Mark Wahlberg movie.
Yeah.
but it's, I'm not sure it's 10 out of 10. but,
okay. All right.
But I like Michael Pena in that too.
Yeah.
But you know, I wish he would. I guess what I wish, because Anton Fuqua is clearly talented. I think I wish he would feel comfortable to sort of stretch more. And,
mm-hmm. And he'd be able to win an Oscar if he uses Denzel, right?
Oh, one might think.
Yeah.
Training Day had multiple Oscar nominations. Yeah. I think so. Oh, I mean, yeah. He's eminently talented. He clearly has, you know, Denzel's cell mm-hmm. phone number. I'm wondering, you know, on the other hand, maybe he's just happy making these kind of films, and that's perfectly
I truly
all right
do
too.
Think The Equalizer is just, he was just enjoying himself.
All right.
Yeah. Well, you don't think so? You think he was trying
no,
to
well, I
make bank with it, or?
I don't think it, well, the first one wasn't that successful, but
a guy like,
I don't think someone twisted him. I don't think someone twisted his arm to make it.
Yeah.
I think he didn't have to make it if he didn't want to.
So that's what I mean. I think Equalizer 2 is one that he really wanted to make.
All right. I just, you know, let's put a cherry on this by saying, like, I had a good time.
I had a good time as well.
It's enjoyable. I think everyone did their jobs, and mm-hmm. it's not going to turn David Cronenberg around on the death of cinema.
No, not at all. Not at all.
All right. Fair enough.
Also, just quickly back to that Cronenberg thing. How do you feel about him getting that award?
Lifetime Achievement?
Yeah.
Well, he's 75.
I guess, yeah. It's just those awards are usually kind of a hint, like, your films were great, but you're done. It's one of those.
You know, it's I guess it's one of those things, like, maybe he is done, and maybe that's why he's turning to writing.
Yeah.
But there are people who I think are not done, that don't get work anymore. Like people like Joe Dante,
mm-hmm.
who, you know, seems to be able to scrounge together a couple of million dollars to make a movie. Or, you know, John Carpenter, who seems to, his work now seems to be about like supervising or giving a stamp of approval to the remakes. Mm-hmm. And his last movie, The Ward, I thought was one of his best ones in terms of his latter part of his career. But, mm-hmm. you know, I mean...
It's because Cronenberg said in what we read that even though directors like Martin Scorsese have made bank and are ridiculously famous, nowadays it's still hard for them to get a film, in the Hollywood, to get a film, you know, a blockbuster film. You know, like I think about the last couple Martin Scorsese's, both just were released in minor theaters, right?
Well, Silence was practically dumped.
Yes, that's what I mean. Silence was practically dumped.
But I mean, then again, Irishman's coming out on Netflix.
Okay. Well, hey, maybe Cronenberg will switch to Netflix.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm still looking forward to that Rabid remake with the Soska sisters. that's it for our show. If you like End Credits, you can find us on endcreditsradioshow.com or on social media, End Credits Radio Show on Facebook, End Credits Radio on Twitter. Peter, where can people find you on the internet?
As per usual, Mr. Talarak. YouTube and Twitter.
There you go. I will be back here on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics and Open Source's Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca. And you can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. We'll be back here next week, Wednesday at 2 p.m. for more End Credits, and we will see you then.